Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org, where history proves that truth, or at least their version of it, is truly stranger than fiction. Today, I'm going to be getting into a subject that really, really matters to me, and that is cover-up culture. I grew up in a world of cover-up culture, as many of you already know, and it changes you. It changes the way you think. It changes the way that you act. After you escape it, it changes the way that you view people. It changes the way that you, if you go to church, it changes the way that you think of church. Cover-up culture is so destructive that for the rest of your life, if you've been involved with it, some aspect of your life will be impacted by cover-up culture. Now, this is really important to me for many reasons. One of the things that I have tried to do is show how many of these movements that exist today have progressed from the same issues that existed back in the Branham movement, and even to some extent before this, because I start to recognize these patterns, and I've not really talked deeply about why I do what I do. I've mentioned a few times it is to help people, but at the core, if you understand the core of all of the work that I do, it's not even to target the individual. Say it's Branham I'm researching. It's not even so much to target Branham. Branham was just a product of the world he lived in and the people that he interacted with. Many of his revelations came directly from other people in the same era who were doing the same thing. But what matters to me is the fact that because cover-up culture exists, all of the problems that exist in Branhamism can come forward into charismatic movement. All of those can come forward into the New Apostolic Reformation. Cover-up culture is a virus and a plague that just threatens, in fact, our entire society. Just today, as I was going through the notes trying to lay out how I'm going to cover this, because this is a delicate topic, and I'll mention why in just a second. As I'm going through this, the news came on and I saw that the prince, Andrew, has been arrested for, I'm not going to give the details and who he's involved with because YouTube might censor, but he was being arrested in a grand scheme of cover-up culture, if you understand what happened there. That cover-up culture exists in the UK, it exists in the United States. Globally, this is a problem, and it's not something that is centralized to Christianity. But because the fact that many people who were in this culture that I'm about to describe had ties to politics, politicians, political agendas, as you understand that framework, you understand how cover-up culture can exist in Christianity. Otherwise, if you just read the Bible makes it clear that cover-up culture is sin. Just pure, plain, and simple, it's sin. Yet it seems to be dominating the Christian religion today. As I said, this work really matters to me, and it has been very, very costly. In fact, recently a private file, a project I had working in progress, was shared outside of our team without authorization, and a few collaborators decided they can't go forward with me if I'm going to release information about a person that I believe is involved with hero worship. Now, this is a huge problem because this shows me that the cover-up culture not only exists in the cults that we came out of, but people have been so impacted by cover-up culture that when they leave, they still remain in that mindset. If we can cover this up, we can continue. I don't work that way. I don't operate that way. And it would be really unfair to the other researchers who have given me a large portion of what I'm about to talk through today. It would be unfair to them if I cover up one group while not covering up another. This is a big problem, if you understand this. In fact, this is a problem I've dealt with for years. One of the problems that I really have is when you have multiple people of multiple groups working together as researchers. Some of those groups may have been impacted positively by something I'm researching, or negative, vice versa. You have researchers who can't work with other researchers because the cover-up culture has trained them to believe that you can't share facts. And for me, I don't have a dog in the fight. I just share the facts. And for the sole purpose not to make any group look bad or any individual, even the heroes that are being worshipped, I don't try to make them look bad. I just want to show the facts and show the history that has been covered up. That's one of the things that I do. And to the point of hero worship, I see hero worship as just a big of a plague that really enables this cover-up culture. I don't care who the hero is. It may have actually been a good person with nothing to cover up. But when you make a human out to be a hero, you're making the wrong, you're worshiping the wrong thing. Hero worship is worship of a human, and the Bible clearly tells you who you're supposed to worship. So in Christianity, I see no place for hero worship. I don't care who it is. Today we're going to be talking about Chuck Smith. Chuck Smith may have had nothing in his past that's bad. I'm not going to say that he did or didn't. But when you have hero worship, and the man becomes more than a man, in Christianity, this is a problem. I'll be mentioning John Wimber. I'll be mentioning Paul Kane. Many of these people are heroes to one group or another. And interestingly, with some of the researchers that I have, they may be the opposite of a hero to them. So you've got this weird battle that I deal with daily. People really have no idea. Years ago, I started to publish all of the research of William Branham and his mentor, Roy Davis. There's a lot of really, really bad things that were happening. And that's part of the history, the culture that I came from, and quite frankly, the culture that developed into exactly what we're talking today. And I had one researcher that was one of my biggest partners, did not want me to publish the information when I found it, because it might make some of the people who had escaped look bad. And I can't operate like that. You cannot tell truth by covering up truth. That's my opinion. So I'm going to be getting into this today. As I said, I'm mentioning Chuck Smith. And it's not that I'm focusing negatively against Chuck Smith. I'm going to be mentioning John Wimber. It's not that I'm really negative against John Wimber. Definitely not. I have no reason to even attack Calvary Chapel or Vineyard. I have no reason to suspect that they have developed in an unhealthy way. I think I've said that a few times. I don't know if people have caught it. I have no reason to suspect this because nobody has shared with me any facts that are critical of that. But there are milestones in the history that are critical and are important. And if you forget those milestones, what happens is history continues to repeat itself exactly as it has done. Leader-centered authority structures create incentives for silence when these allegations surface if they've become a hero and they've entered into a realm of destructiveness within the church that enables all kinds of problems with the church. So the recent example, Bethel. Bethel is having huge problems right now, and they have publicly acknowledged several failures in their process, the silence, the mishandling. If you understand what that is, it goes back to the culture that I'm about to talk about today. And Bethel is just one of the, I'm going to say it like this because I don't think people realize, Bethel is actually a victim of what I'm talking about today. Not that Bethel's good by no means or bad by no means, I'm not going to say either, but they are a victim. Had this culture not existed, this problem within Bethel may have never existed. Go all the way back down the chain. Had this cover-up culture not existed, look at IHOP KC. Would they have had the problems? Probably not. The problems may have existed in certain individuals, but without the cover-up culture, it would have been stopped very quickly. So I see cover-up culture as one of the most important things that I could possibly talk about. Recently, I went through an example of cover-up culture that not many people were aware of. And I want to touch on this just a bit because there are so many different movements, leaders, heroes within hero worship within this point in time, this intersection, that they're all connected in one way or another. And people have no idea of the connections because of the cover-up culture. I recently went through a transcript where Paul Kane had confronted Chuck Smith along with Jack Deere. Jack Deere was present, and Paul Kane was confronting Chuck Smith for remarks that were made by Smith at a pastor's conference that were circulating on tape recording. And this is an example of what happens within cover-up culture behind the scenes that people never see. This gives us an inside view into cover-up culture. And you can find this document on my website. If you go to the Paul Kane page and go to the publication section, you'll find this document. But to summarize it, Paul Kane is upset, clearly upset if you read through the transcript, and he's taking offense with some remarks that Chuck Smith apparently made about high-flying lifestyle, money, offering allegations, and basically marks against Paul Kane's reputation. And this would have caused Paul Kane severe damage to his ministry. I don't know that he really would have recovered from this. And again, look at this intersection in time. Had Paul Kane been stopped, then would there have been an IHOP KC? If not an IHOP KC, how far would the NAR have developed with its Seven Mountains Mandate agenda? You can almost go through time with all of these milestones and see that these intersections in time are very, very important. And again, it's not really to say anything negatively about Chuck Smith in this instance, except for this one thing. Smith was a product of cover-up culture, and if you understand what is being said in this transcript, and again, this is a recording that Paul Kane made, and then watch the actions that are taken afterwards, Chuck Smith issues a letter retracting his statements that were made on tape recording. So we don't know the intentions of the hearts of the men who were involved in that meeting, but what we do see is there was clearly an attempt to cover things up. And that's the point I want to stress. I don't want to go too deeply with what each person was thinking and why. You can never prove this. I can tell you what it looks like, but you cannot prove that. So facts are facts. Kane alleges this thing against Chuck Smith. Chuck Smith makes a retraction, and we have this milestone in history that we can continue forward with. So for today's episode, I want to go into the cover-up culture just a bit more, and I am going to be diving deeper into the relationship between Chuck Smith, John Wimber, Lonnie Frisbee, these figures that were, to me, they were really important as an intersection. And I'm going to be doing it slightly different. Most of you who know the podcast know that I have a style that is a little bit abrasive, and I do that on purpose. It's actually not my personality to do this, but when I do, it gets people talking, and they usually focus their anger against me instead of each other. And so it's actually a strategy that I'm doing. If I can get this group of people angry at me, they start talking. Well, this other group start talking to them, and you can just watch it in the comment feeds. Everybody learns something, and I'm the bad guy. But today, I want to not use my normal style. I just want to talk through the facts because this is so important to me. I have huge questions, and these questions are very serious questions. They're not something that I should be joking about. In fact, I'm working with a more than one public figure on this area of research, and I took some very needed advice that I need to change my tone, at least for this particular podcast, because it is the intersection, is the hub of information for several different threads of streams of history. Some of those streams turned out really good. Some of those streams turned out really bad. And on both sides, you can't cover up the facts. But what you can do is just tell them like they are. I'm not going to use my abrasive style. And I'm going to share some of the research that are just simply facts. They're nothing more than facts. But it may lead to people talking, and I may actually get some more research. So this is me fishing a bit, trying to get some people to send facts that they might have to combine it with all of the other researchers who are working with me on this particular subject. So I'm going to get into that a bit. But again, let's go back to the cover-up culture. Smith responded, but the conversation centers upon one aspect. If you read through it, Kane is clearly upset that Chuck Smith has outed him as a homosexual. So I'm going to touch this delicately as well. This is a very important fact because it ties to some other cover-up culture. And I'm not going to address the issue of homosexuality. You guys can fight that out among yourselves. If you want to know more about homosexuality and what the Bible says about it, go to your pastor and let them talk through it. But within the movement, regardless of what has happened today with that subject and how it's been politicized, at that point in time, this was a big issue. During William Branham's revivals, it was learned that multiple men working with him were homosexual at a time when homosexual acts were criminalized in the United States and Canada. William Branham mentions this on recording.
Now, when I was in Canada, they picked up this fella and went up there and said, right in amongst a bunch of Norwegians, and he said, the Lord tells me that somebody in your crowd about 10 times this size, somebody by the name of John, maybe Johannes, Joanne, said, right along in here, I believe. He said, no, said, it's right along in here somewhere. Of course, he took him out. In a Norwegian country, everybody, 90% of them is Petersons, Carlsons, John, Johannes, and, well, certainly, see, certainly it's got to get in there somewhere. Then the Lord tells me somebody's got back trouble. I feel my back hurting. Anybody that's been raised through the scripture knows that that's psychology. That certainly is. But see what it do? Then the man was picked up right there by the FBI from here, sent up there and picked him up there. The Royal Mounted Police, the Ministerial Association come to me, and a homosexual. They say, well, Brother Branham's probably the same thing. That's just the way it runs, see?
Now, this was a big issue for multiple reasons during that era. And while the sin of homosexuality, if you view it as such today, still would be the same as back then, the laws were quite different. As I mentioned, there were people that were arrested. This was a big deal for many ways. But the biggest of which is this. Within the movement, they taught very strongly that if you were a homosexual, you had a demon. And as such, if you had this homosexual demon, there were people who were victimized who were homosexual by a group of people who believed that they could never be saved because this is something that came within them. This wasn't something that they were able to even choose according to that line of thinking. So, in other words, it was a branding. You had a scarlet letter, you were homosexual, you were outcast. But at the same time, there were multiple leaders within the movement who were homosexual, many of which had rank and importance. Paul Kane is just one of the figures, but William Branham's campaign manager, the Baron William T. Freire von Blumberg, was also homosexual. That is important for multiple reasons. Not only is he William Branham's campaign manager, he toured with William Branham throughout Europe, taking William Branham and spreading Branhamism across the world. And he was a director in the Fellowship Foundation, The Family, if you've watched Netflix and watched The Family Cult. The Family is tied to places like Bethel. There are quotes out there. You can find them on the internet if you want to go look. But Bethel is connected to high-ranking figures in The Family. The Family is connected to Branhamism. They used to support the National Prayer Breakfast, etc. So this was a very public figure. And it was known within the inner circle that he was an avowed homosexual. Also touring with William Branham, Branham called them his tape boys. They were two homosexual men who were basically the scribes of the religion. When William Branham would preach, they would record it. They would distribute the recordings that are going out on cassette tapes. That was happening within Branhamism. But the two figures who led the entire tape recording and distribution organization were both homosexual, and it was covered up. It's all part of the cover-up culture. And in fact, I'll let you listen to William Branham's publicist, Lee Vail, and see what he says about it.
There was with that group that went to Europe, a Christian pro-gospel businessman identified with them named Ferry von Blumberg. Even the name is typical, Ferry. And not trying to be facetious, but look at it, it's absolutely true. That was his name, and he was an avowed homosexual. And at the same time, Leo and Jean, two homosexuals, attached themselves to Brother Branham's ministry as tape boys, which was allowed by God.
Notice that phrase, which was allowed by God? Because that's going to be important as I get deeper into this. This is an example of what is known by several people as the Moses model. It was allowed by God. Moses is the anointed. Touch not God's anointed. There's that loaded language that's being spread through the movement. Touch not God's anointed. They're anointed by God. They're untouchable. They do not have accountability. That was the framework that developed in Branhamism. And that same framework, as I'll display in this podcast, it continued all through the Jesus movement, the charismatic movement, all the way to the New Apostolic Reformation. The Moses model is really the problem. It is a model that allows hero worship. It is a model that makes the heroes, the Moseses, makes them untouchable. And more than that, it makes the people submit to a new deity. The heroes in the hero worship actually become the deity. And so they're worshiping actually false gods. And the religion itself isn't so much about Christianity. Jesus isn't the hero that's being worshiped. It's these stage personas. To Chuck Smith's favor, he did not like the stage persona model. He did walk away from this, and you can find several biographies where he says, no, we don't like that. The Latter Rain movement had all of these tent meetings, these stage personas. People were worshiping the leaders as though they were gods among men. I can't remember his exact phrasing. Don't quote me on that. But he did not like it, and he shifted away from that. That's a good thing. The problem is there were attributes that were destructive that were carried forward, which I'll get into. One of them includes the Moses model. Now, homosexuality is just one of the problems. If you look at the church today that exists from this movement, there are an array of other problems, from financial to sexual to all sorts of problems. Within the organization that was being established that would lead to all of this that we're talking about today, homosexuality is just one aspect of it. There were also problems that they were aware of that existed between men and women in the movement. And William Branham's publicist also goes on to talk about the leader, one of the leaders of the shepherding movement, Arne Baxter. Baxter was the Baxter half of the Baxter Branham campaigns. He was William Branham's campaign manager. He also toured through Europe, so he was aware of all of these things, potentially aware of all these things going on. I would say that you almost can't not know, but I can't say that he did or not. He toured with William Branham, and as he's touring, there were some issues that apparently, allegedly, took place, and William Branham's publicist, Lee Vail, talks about the problems with Arne Baxter.
In 1954, Brother Branham went to India, where there was a Mount Carmel showdown, for all the great religions of the world were there. The Buddhists, the Mohammedans, the Christians, Catholics, Roman, no doubt, all the various types, Protestants, what have you. They were there for the great showdown. When Brother Branham went to India, he took with him some people. And I believe unknown to Brother Branham was one man. I'm not sure that Duplessy got him there or Arne Baxter. And I'm going to speak very plainly, and I've said it before, and I'm not the least alarmed to say it because it's the truth. Baxter was a womanizer. He even got drunk on the plane and came off doing a goose step and everybody laughing at him. In India, he consorted with women. They came to Brother Branham and said, is it right for the father to have these women?
So let's pause just a minute and let's talk through some of these connections that I've just mentioned. So we began with Chuck Smith, who went on to found Calvary Chapel. Chuck Smith, who worked with Lonnie Frisbee, who was homosexual, and Chuck Smith parted ways apparently over the homosexuality and some of the other things that was happening. Lonnie Frisbee, who also worked with John Wimber, who is mentioned also in this transcript that took place whenever Paul Kane confronted Chuck Smith. So Wimber apparently was in the know. Chuck Smith was in the know. Lonnie Frisbee worked with the shepherding movement, and even, according to his biographies, lived in an apartment that was owned by one of the leaders of the shepherding movement. The shepherding movement, which was led by Ern Baxter. Baxter, who I just mentioned, was Branham's campaign manager and accused of several things that were apparently misconduct. So you've got all of this hub of connections. William Branham's scribes, the two that were mentioned that were homosexual, what they did was so far worse than homosexuality. So in a way, whether you believe in that homosexuality is a sin and should be stopped immediately, or whether you're in the more liberal camp of Christianity, in either case, if you look at what happened and the abuse that followed, had they been stopped immediately and there wasn't cover-up culture, it would not have led to the very destructive compound that they called the Park. It was a community in Prescott, Arizona, which is a location where Chuck Smith had a church, interestingly. They had a commune that made actually the Supreme Court of California a trial talking about all sorts of things that were apparently happening in the church. And it is on court record. It's not something that I'm saying from rumor. You can actually go read about all kinds of misconduct from sexual to physical. It is a bad, bad thing. Had it not been covered up, that would have been stopped. Ern Baxter, if that is true, what is being said, had it been covered up, had it not been covered up, then would we have a shepherding movement? The shepherding movement was a very authoritarian structure. It took the Moses model to new extremes because the Moses was at the top of the pyramid and there were shepherds who were shepherding other shepherds below them who were shepherding on down the chain. And quite frankly, if you really understand the structure that they developed, this is the same structure that created the model that was carried forward by the New Apostolic Reformation for the apostles and prophets that are untouchable. They're at the top, the people are at the bottom, and there's an authoritarian structure that exists. So my point in bringing all of this up is there was a culture that was designed to cover things up. And the leadership were participating, some of them knowingly, some of them unknowingly, in the cover-up culture. And the people, by and large, had no idea what's going on. And things underneath behind the closed doors, there were things happening that, had they known, many of the people would have fled each one of these movements that I'm talking about. Now, did the movements evolve into something healthy? Maybe. I've not heard anything to suggest that Calvary Chapel is a cult today or that Vineyard Church is a cult today. But there was a milestone in history when the heroes that were being worshipped, and to some people are still worshipped today, the heroes apparently were covering things up. Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started, or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the latter rain, charismatic, and other fringe movements into the New Apostolic Reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support.
Such men. Really? He used to say, Paul, if you don't use your gifts for the church more, the Lord's going to take them away from you and he's going to punish you. And he was more Pentecostal than I ever was. And
Chuck Smith.
Yeah, he really. Well, he was supply pastor for the first Four Square Church in Phoenix. And so there was one of the sponsors of my meeting at Madison Square Gardens, which was not the, you know, the main thing in New York, but this was what they called it in Phoenix. It was a wrestling arena and all that, a sports arena.
Okay.
And so we were filling that twice a day, and he was my worship leader. And then he became my campaign manager.
As I mentioned before, I would be sharing some of the research, not all, but some that I have into Chuck Smith, Calvary Chapel, John Wimber, and the Vineyard Movement. Again, not to be critical of those movements as they exist today, but this intersection is very, very important and very critical. I can't yet share all of the facts, but I will say this. I have multiple researchers who are working with me that are sharing all sorts of facts about these people and these movements. Some of the people sharing the facts with me had a very, very negative experience in the movement. Not that the movement is the cause of it. It may or may not be. I don't know. But these people, they're broken like I am. They came from a situation that should have never existed. And it all goes back to this Moses model that's being created. This is a model that was carried forward. And it may not fully exist today, but there was a point in time in which it did. And we'll get into that in just a little bit. But I want to preface with this. I have a lot of people sharing a lot of facts. Some of those people are very upset at what happened to them, and I will not decrease or lessen their experience. Their experience is their experience. I won't try to cover up what they went through or the facts that they're sharing with me. But at the same time, I do want to qualify it. Some of the facts that are shared with me, I take with a grain of salt. The fact may look a certain way, but until we get all of the facts, it's not really something that you can say definite. You can just say, well, here are the facts, and it looks very bad. And I do have a lot of questions about some of those facts, which I'll get into that in just a minute. But the point I'm trying to make is this. If you have transparency, you don't have to try to rebuild biographies. And that's really what my website, my podcast is having to do. We're having to go back and rebuild the correct version of all of these biographies because of the cover-up culture that exists. Many, many leaders, they try to cover up their past. And I understand talking about the good things. That makes sense. But when it's something that is so devastating that it impacts lives, there comes a point whenever later biographers, they really need to publish the critical facts. Because if you don't do this, history continues to repeat itself. So I'm going to get into some of that research, but the thing that I'll mention here, we just listened to a recording by Paul Kane. Paul Kane is describing how connected these movements are. And whether it's true or not, I have seen that there are arguments as to whether Paul Kane was lying through his teeth or not. I'm not to say, but what I can say is, some of the details that he has just mentioned about him working with Chuck Smith, some of those details are verified even by the newspapers. So I'm not going to say that he's fully correct and Chuck Smith was that deeply connected to him, as he says, but he did say it, and that is a fact. So I can take that fact, and now I can combine it with other facts and paint a bigger picture. So let's think through that a bit. Say that Paul Kane is correct. And at minimum, we know that he is so connected with Chuck Smith that they've had a private encounter. Now enter Lonnie Frisbee into the equation. Lonnie Frisbee was part of what I mentioned before, this attempt to cover up homosexuality by some people. I have no evidence yet that Chuck Smith was covering it up. I think if you read any historical account, Chuck Smith cut him off the moment he found out. We just don't know what happened leading up to that moment. And that's, for me, that's the question. That's a big question. What we do see is Chuck Smith Jr. There are reports out there, some of them in the news, that talk about Chuck Smith found out that there was a six-month relationship between two men, Lonnie Frisbee and another leader. And this had been going on for 6 months, and he went to John Wimber. And if you read the Wimber biographies, it says that Wimber found out and then cut him off. But if you read the report from the Chuck Smith Jr. angle, Chuck Smith found out that it had been going on for months, confronts John Wimber, and then John Wimber mentioned that he knew about it. And then later after that encounter, he cut it off. So I can tell you that there's a lot of gray in that. It's not so black and white as the biographies make it out. But the fact that the cover-up culture exists become a problem. The reason why this is important as it relates to the grand scheme of all of the research, Chuck Smith Jr. went on to finally separate himself. And I know that depending on which side you took of that debate, which I don't have a dog in the fight, depending on which side you took, he's either a hero or he's a villain. One or the other, because this is a big deal. One of the things that he mentioned as part of the reason why the separation happened was homosexuality. So that becomes a key milestone in history. That's a fact. Now we need to look at the other facts that are supportive. I had one researcher who sent me a lot of information. I've not even shared all of it yet. And in fact, I'm sharing some of it freshly in this podcast. But there was a statement made by Chuck Smith Jr. that led them down the path of researching and finding that there's a lot more curious history, I'll say it like that, curious history that exists. And I'm sharing it because I'm sharing in transparency. I don't yet know what to make of it, and I would like for other people to weigh in. But this research, depending on which way it goes, it either paints everything in a different light, or it's just a side fact and the research means nothing. It's one or the other. But there was a statement made by Chuck Smith Jr. I think the year was 2010. And he uses the word partner when talking about two women. Now, when this was shared with me, I'm going to be fully transparent. I can't prove it either way. There's no way to prove homosexuality unless the person either admits it or gets caught in it. But I will say that in 2010, if you were talking about two ministers, both of the same sex, and you use the word partner, it raises a question that really can't be answered unless you just openly ask, what did you mean by this? Now, I'm just going to let that go. But there's a fact that I think paints a bigger picture of something that is unusual happening. And I'm going to share that research. I'm not trying to make one way or the other what this research means, but this is an example of one area of research that our researchers are going down. So Chuck Smith Jr., he mentions that there are these two partners. And again, you probably would use pastor and co-pastor in that situation. I can't think of an example where, if it was two men, I would not say that these two men who are living together in the same house, under the same roof, behind the same closed doors, they're partners. I would never say this. I would say it was a pastor and a co-pastor. But he did use the word partner, and then what he says next is really what caused this researcher, I think, to go down the depth of research that they did.
Of course, Mom had many bright memories. God did plant good in her life. The brightest for her was knowing Jesus from a young age. Her love for Jesus was fed to her by her older sister, as Cheryl said, our Aunt E.C., who my dad described as a magical woman. Imagine my dad using a term like magical. But he said E.C. was a magical woman because when she came, everything brightened up. She really was a source of hope for Mom. And Mom loved every visit and every conversation she had with her sister. My Aunt E.C., by the way, some Calvary Chapel pastors may not like this, she was the senior pastor of the First Four Square Church in Phoenix, Arizona. And my dad adored her and felt that her partner, Mary Jane May, was a very gifted preacher, and he enjoyed listening to her preach. Dirty little secrets of Calvary Chapel. Okay, so...
So this particular researcher, whenever the statement was made and they heard this, they went down this long path of research because I'm going to say this very plainly for people who may be part of the movement and may see any research as negative. Whenever you're in a culture that potentially even has the hint of cover-up culture or even just a simple lack of transparency, When you hear a statement like that, if you have a critical mind like I do, you're going to go down the path of trying to figure out, well, what's going on behind this? That why would that statement be made? Well, that's exactly what this researcher did. And what they found out, it raises a lot of questions. I can't say that it gives any answers, but it raises some significant questions. The person that he is referring to, EC, was a nickname, and EC was the head of the Arizona District for the Four Square Church, which is the church that Chuck Smith began his ministry in. And throughout the course of all of the research that they've shared with me, it appears, based off of what I can see in this, that if not for EC, Chuck Smith may have had a different history in how he became a minister. He was trained in the Life Bible College, but he had a sister-in-law who was the head of the Arizona district. So the sister-in-law gave him a pulpit. He, you know, very quickly rose up through the ranks of the Four Square Church. Had this not been his sister-in-law, and had he not had that connection, would the entire Jesus movement have even existed? I don't know. It's hard to say what would have happened if a certain fact or a certain piece of history did not exist. But what I can say is, it looks very much like this was a significant person to Chuck Smith. The researcher also shared with me that this female pastor always had a parsonage for, I can't remember how many different people, but usually it was a assistant pastor or a co-pastor sharing the same parsonage, which is kind of unusual until you think about the way the Four Square Church operated. Amy Semple McPherson was the head. She was a female minister. And so if you had a female minister as the head of the organization, would not you have female ministers in the churches? Yes, you would. Where it gets a little bit, I don't know, questionable for me is, how do the parsonages work? That does seem a little bit odd. I'm trying to think of an example outside of Foursquare where, say, it's two male ministers. In what situation would you have two male ministers in the same parsonage, and not just one, but multiple of those? It seems odd to me. Most of the ministries that I'm familiar with, if that were a situation and you had a male minister, you may have a temporary second minister who's being trained or something like this, but they usually go out and they start their own church. Because the idea of a minister is that you become a minister so that you can plant a church, you can grow a congregation, and you can further the gospel of Jesus Christ. I can't think of too many situations where two male ministers would stay in the same room and board. That it's just odd to me. I'm not saying it's wrong, but it is odd to me. Now, in the 1940 census, this researcher found that if you look at EC, she is the head of household, and then if you look at the lady who's living with her, it's listed as partner. And to the researcher, this was highly unusual, and to me, it is unusual. I had to do some digging to figure this out, because that word partner, in language of 2010, whenever it was said, yes, it had the connotation of homosexuality or lesbianism, but did it in 1940? That was my question. And what I found out actually raised more questions than gave answers. So I looked at the 1940 instructions for this word, partner, and the 1940 instructions told the enumerators, if two or more persons who are not related by blood or marriage share a common dwelling unit as partners, write head for one and partner for the other or others. So within the context of two women living in the same dwelling place, there was an enumeration, there was a relationship, and there was a code for using the word partner. So if you look at just that alone, that makes sense, and I can't say that there's anything wrong with that. However, there were other words that were used, and usually, from what I can tell from the research, and I am no expert by no means, but from what I can tell from researchers who are looking into 1940, partner was usually suggesting that they were some sort of a business relationship. Was the church a business? It could have been, I don't know. But there were other words that also could have been used. And from what I can tell, just based off of the simplest statistics I've been able to find, the word partner was used so rarely. It was common to that situation, but in the grand scheme of all the relationships, partner was an unusual word. I'll say it like that. All of that said, the word partner doesn't necessarily mean homosexual, but what I did find that it raises a question, it doesn't answer it. When researchers want to go back in time to a period in time in which homosexuals were all had to be under the closet because the vast majority of people were against it, they look for the word partner in the census. Not that the word partner means homosexual, but that's the only way that you can find people who are not husband and wife. That's why they do it. So from the researcher's point of view, they went down the right path. That is exactly what you do. You look in the census, did they use the word partner? So to credit the researcher, that's perfectly legit. Again, it doesn't prove anything though, because this is, like I said, this is just a word. It means nothing. But for me, it's a fact. And it is important because through this fact and through their research, I learned that Chuck Smith his ministry was helped to be launched by a female who was the head of the primary head of the state of Arizona for the Four Square Church. And she apparently planted the Phoenix Church where Chuck Smith first began speaking, or early began speaking, I should say. So this is a significant set of facts. Does it all mean and imply what the researcher is suggesting? No, not necessarily. But that's a fact, and that's an important fact. Here is why that research is so important to me. I can place William Branham in that exact church, that church where Chuck Smith is preaching, EC is preaching. EC's name was Louise Webster. She went by the nickname EC. And if I look through the transcripts of Branham's sermons, I can find him in that church. Chuck Smith may have even been present. I don't know. But the point is this. The Four Square Church was very accepting of William Branham. We have talked about that in our Revival History series. If not for the Four Square Church, Branhamism may not have existed. So there's some huge facts to combine here. But the point I'm trying to make is Branhamism created a model that was continued forward through time. It was the Moses model. Branham called it the Elijah model, or different names for this. Basically, it's the manifested sons of God, but there's one figure that's manifestation is greater than the rest. In Branham's case, he claimed to be the manifested Elijah of the day, but it was the Moses model. The leaders were untouchable. They were anointed by God, and touch not God's anointed. That was the framework that developed. There's another aspect, though, that I think is really significant for people to realize. Churches in Branhamism did not have a central governing authority. What they had instead was the Moses model, where each church was responsible for their own people. And if some problem happened within that church, you can never go to the leadership and say that it's their fault, because they're disconnected as governing bodies of the church. So every message church that's in the message cult, the group that I came out of, every one of them is independent. If you look at what has been set up, that model continued. And there are some significant flaws, in my opinion, with that model, because if you take away the governing structure, there's no accountability. Each church, if they have the Moses model, the Moseses, if that's a word, they're all untouchable. And that came to a head in the year 2007. Newspapers and magazines called it a day of reckoning. And this is an important milestone in history that I don't think has been covered as much as it should have. Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa, according to the newspaper reports, sometimes hired pastors who had been recently removed from their churches for misconduct and immorality. And it mentions an example. It says in 1992, the board of Calvary Church, Santa Ana, which is not affiliated with Calvary Chapel, removed its then prominent pastor, David Hawking, for having had an affair. Within 3 months, Chuck Smith hired him. This report goes on to talk about the abuses that were happening. Now, those abuses weren't directly tied to Chuck Smith, other than the fact that, you know, if this is correct, he hired somebody who he probably shouldn't have. But Chuck Smith talks about how he views the Moses model and why. And he distances himself from the problem. He's, like I mentioned with the Branham cult, he's at the head of the organization. The churches, they're responsible for themselves. They're not accountable to anyone. They're accountable only to God. And that's the way he phrased it. That separates responsibility. And it creates a situation where, A, cover-up culture can continue. B, it follows very closely the BITE model. If you're familiar with Dr. Stephen Hassan's BITE model of authoritarian control, this is a model that is used to determine, is a group a cult or not? And I want to qualify this statement. I don't believe that Calvary Chapel as a whole is a cult. But if you look at this one particular instance in time, and then look at one particular church in question, you can apply the BITE model straight down. Behavioral control. You find enforced submission to leaders as God's anointed. Information control. Not many people were aware that this was even going on. There was restricted access to financial info, apparently. Decision-making records, independent investigations. Simply put, if you read all of the newspaper articles and magazine articles that came out, both pro and con, you find that there was a lack of transparency, a general lack of transparency. And to the people who are sitting in the pews, this is control of information. The T in the BITE model, thought control, the phrase comes up in several newspaper articles, touch not God's anointed. And if you're questioning it, you have the rebellion like Korah, or you have a critical spirit. It always goes back to the spirit. That is a mechanism for thought control. And the emotional control, I think, is fairly obvious if you look at just simply the structure and the nature of what developed from Latter Rain. But there's a fear of being labeled rebellious. There's a guilt and shame if you're not quiet, if you're not compliant. There are phobias that are implanted, indoctrinated into the movement. If you leave, you'll shipwreck your faith or ruin your family. Now, the newspapers did not go too deep with the emotional control, but they did describe some of what I just said. And from working with Dr. Stephen Hassan, the BITE model is not a definite, it's a cult, it's not a cult. It's a continuum that shows the level of cultic nature in a group. So you may be small on the scale and you may be okay, or you may be very, very destructive and be just, you know, there's no question you're a cult. That's how the scale works. So I applied the scale to the church that had the abuse. That one instance, that's been disbanded. There's not much more to say about it, other than the fact that for me, the most important part of this is that this is a significant milestone in history. And as I continue the research, this intersection in time between all of these figures, some of whom did go on to develop very destructive cults. Paul Kane, look at what happened with Kansas City Fellowship, IHOP KC. Look how that relates to Bethel. Bethel's working directly with these people. This is a problem, but this is an intersection in history between different figures of different movements who all pattern themselves off of the revivals, which had the Moses model. So in one aspect, I can say the Moses model is the problem. However, it's not just the Moses model that creates the problem. If you have the Moses model where there is no accountability, there is no transparency, and you start to cover things up that might make people question your spiritual authority, for me, that is where the problem lies. And I can say that in this intersection in history, some of these groups developed into very healthy groups. At least I have no information that they did not. Others, however, they went down the wrong path. So I hope this gives you a view into my world. I've gone a little bit out of my usual, as I said I would, because this is a very serious subject for me. This is not something that my usual laughing, joking self that I put out in these podcasts, it's really not something that I should cover like that, because this is serious. This has developed into problems that have ruined lives of people. Multiple people, you can listen to them on Friday. They talk about their stories and their experiences. And I'm not one to question those experiences. To them, that is a very real experience. Some of the people who have been contacting me won't even come on the podcast, but they talk about the very groups that I'm mentioning in this podcast, and they had a very, very negative experience. Each time I talk to somebody who has, it comes down to the Moses model and the cover-up culture. So for me, this is extremely serious, and it's not something that we should take lightly. So hopefully you can see a view into my world, all of the many things that I have to deal with, and understand that what I'm trying to do is not only correct the history that's been written in incorrectly, I want to help people to understand why this is a problem, because there are many, many people who are hurt by this. So if you've enjoyed this research and the show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org. For more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, you can read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR, available on Amazon, Kindle, and Audible.